Welcome to Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. I am your host, Henrik Johansson. I am the CEO and one of the founders of Gemba. Gemba helps entrepreneurs and companies to turn their great ideas into awesome new consumer products. Please stay to the end of the podcast and you'll learn how you can be our next guest on Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. Let's do it. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Innovator Insights. This is a podcast where we talk to successful entrepreneurs about their journey, and not just about the good stuff, but the hard stuff, too. Today, we're excited to have as a guest a man who's been a serial entrepreneur, has started many companies, invested in even more companies, and he is the author of a new book called The Entrepreneur's Odyssey. Welcome to the podcast, Andrew Ackerman.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. We're excited to talk about it. Before we jump into this book, which I'm super interested to talk to you about, just a teaser to those who are listening, it's really written for more VC-funded tech startups, because that's most of Andrew's background, and most of our listeners are more bootstrap product startups. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's a ton of parallels. There's a ton of insights and learnings from VC world that I think we could also apply or should apply more in the product space. So super excited to dig into that. But first, before we talk book and business, tell us a little about yourself. Where do you live? What do you do when you're not writing books or starting companies?
I'm coming to you from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. It's great. We do brunch well. You know, there are cooler parts of Manhattan, but that's what we do. I got three teenage daughters, so like the phrase "in my spare time" is like, I can't say that without kind of laughing at myself. Yeah. But you know, when I'm not out there talking to startups or talking to you, you know, I will try to do a little bit of reading for pleasure. I'll ski when the weather's good for that. I'll run when the weather's good for that. And then sometimes around like 11:30 to 12:30, I may binge some TV that like no one else in my family wants to watch with me.
Great. Awesome. So again, before we talk about the book, let's talk about your little bit about your entrepreneurial days. When did you start companies, straight out of college, or did you come from an entrepreneurial family? Was it sort of in the blood or something that evolved later in life?
Yeah. So much about my life, it's like, it kind of only makes sense in retrospect. Yeah. It's not a very linear progression. I was actually, a funny story. I was actually just asked this question. I don't get asked it very often. I ask all my founders, you know, that, but I was just asked this question on a podcast I did an hour ago with a Nigerian podcaster.
All right.
So you and Aro are the only two people to ask me, like, am I really an entrepreneur like the people I invest in?
Yeah.
So it's ironic, right? So my grandfather was the entrepreneur, like coming out of World War II. He did everything from Zippo lighters to insurance products. And I knew I always wanted to do that. But like so many people who were the children of kind of business people who had a hustle and they were always kind of worried, will this work? Will it not work? They wanted their kids to be in, you know, single quote, safe professions. So my dad was a doctor.
Yeah.
By the way, my other grandfather was also an entrepreneur. He owned candy shops, like his things, like candy and news shops. He would open up one in like an iffy neighborhood, get it good, neighborhood would start going in the right direction. He'd sell it and he'd do it again. So for me, it skipped a generation, but yeah. I wanted to do that.
Cool. And when, what was the first one for you?
So also funny, I came out of undergrad and then I did the exact opposite of doing a startup. I went to grad school. I went to business school straight through. And then coming out of business school, it was the mid 90s. So yeah, I'm old. And what I wanted to do, this whole startup, tech startup thing, didn't really exist, right? Like if you told someone you were an entrepreneur, it's like, oh, you're unemployed.
Yeah.
So, you know, I kind of looked around. I was going to Chicago booth. So like, you know, door on the right's for investment banking, door on the left is for consulting. I knew I didn't want to be a banker. So I did 4 years of consulting. And it wasn't until I was on this project in London, of all places, for two big companies that were merging. And I don't know how much your audience knows, but when two companies are merging, like there's antitrust laws. Mm. So the merger can be blocked, but you can't wait for that. You have to go ahead. So you have teams of people that are trying to bring together what this company will look like if it merges. And they get to see the other company's books. So if the merger doesn't go through, they're out of
Know
luck.
everything.
They can't go back to their old jobs. So it's kind of hard to get people for that. So we had built, this is 1999, we had built this intranet program where people could enter their numbers blind. And we push the button and then we go out to dinner and come back a half hour later and we get pro forma financials for the merged company. So I remember as we're working on it, like, that's it. That's what I want to do. Didn't exist 4 years ago when I graduated, but now it's happening. And that was my aha moment. I moved back to New York. Within 9 months, I was at my first startup, and that's all she wrote.
Great. And were you the original founder, or you joined a startup?
I was the third founder. I was the third founder to join. It was actually a friend from business school. We were sitting around. This is like, again, like 2000, 2001, talking about all the stupid startup ideas. Like, how did they get $10 million? And then he starts telling me this this idea about a company that services summer camps. They're going to do the photo galleries for them. They're going to do all these things for them. And I'm like, huh, that one may not suck. That's interesting. And he goes, oh, you should tell my brother that because he and his friend are about to start it. So
All
that's how I became
right.
the founder.
Oh, great. And you did several startups, correct?
I've done two startups. The first one was a success. The second one, have you ever heard the phrase "experience is what you get when you give them what you
I
wanted"?
got one of those.
That was a hell of an experience.
Raised a bunch of money, and then mine was during the dot-com days where everything was going incredibly well.
Right up until it wasn't.
And then suddenly one day didn't,
Yeah. So my first one was right during that, 2001 boom. We made it through that all right. We, of course, by all right, I mean we went for a year without salary until it started to pick up. So, like, that's common to all kinds of entrepreneurs starting a business. It was all right. That was the one that went well. The other one was founder drama.
That's also common. I mean, I've been part of several different CEO groups, and I'd say, funding issues or founder issues are absolutely the most common things you run into.
I wouldn't argue with it all. I know some people that will say all teams, all car startups die because of founder issues. It's just triggered by something else. We ran out of money, couldn't figure out what we were going to do. It's kind of like saying, all death is heart failure. Now, you were in a car accident and your heart was crushed and then it failed. I mean, you could be a little didactic that way, but at the end of the day, there's few things more stressful than trying to run a business together with somebody else. So it's not surprising that that's the point of failure for a lot of companies.
No doubt. There's a ton of pressure, and often you don't know if you're going to survive or not. And sharing that with people that you may or may not know that well, and all types of personal quirks and behaviors and insecurities tend to come out, and it's not easy to navigate.
Yeah, I don't know if you know this or if your listeners know this about VC, but there are a lot of VC investors who will not invest in husband and wife teams for that reason. It's so intense, and then you go home and it's still that. They just hard rule won't do that. I've actually invested in three husband and wife teams, and none of them have failed for that reason. Some have done quite well, but I was looking back at it, and the three teams I'm thinking about. In two cases, the woman was a CEO and the man was a CTO. She was in charge. And in both those cases, they seem to be going well, knock wood. They might not be awesome returns for me in one case, but going well. And in the third case, where it was the husband that was the CEO and the wife that was the chief marketing officer, that one failed, though it's not clear. Exactly. It didn't, the marriage is still good. They're on to doing something else together. But I've gotten kind of lucky that way, kind
That's
of bucking the trend.
maybe not statistically significant, but really interesting observation. And I totally that aligns with what I would expect.
I will say one thing. I don't know, defense, like just to prove that I'm not crazy, these weren't brand new startups. nor brand new marriages. So these were startups that had been out there for 2, 3 years already. So in part, like my philosophy was like, if one of them were going to break, it probably would have broken already.
Yeah, it's a good insight. So what, how did you make the transition from entrepreneur to investor?
Oh, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah.
No, so I'll give you a little more color on that. God, I started saying more color. It's such a banker thing to say, and it drives me nuts. Yeah, so did my first startup. In between my two startups, I worked at a family office, which, for those of you who aren't familiar with a family office, it's usually a rich old person or the family of a rich old person who have a lot of money and they need people to invest it for them and maybe give it away to charity. Not my guy, zero charity. So he only needed one person, not two people. So I did that for a couple of years. Then I had my second startup. And then as I was thinking about doing a third startup, I partly by fortuitous coincidence got connected with a group called Dream It Ventures. So they are an accelerator and a VC fund. At the time, they still are the third oldest in the world. At the time, they were one of the top five or top 10 accelerators in the world. And I'd heard that they were looking for someone to take over the New York office. Now, I had done maybe five angel investments at that time, in addition to like my startup and the stuff I was doing. And I would joke around with people like, hey, if I could just get paid to go to Starbucks and meet with startups, give them advice, maybe invest in them so often, like that'd be my dream job. And then that was this. And as luck would have it, or not so much luck, because I kind of designed it this way, I knew the guy who was running the program. Like I knew the guy that was running the program. So I pick up the phone and I say, hey, Mark, so this job posting, is this good for you or is this bad for you? And his response was, oh man, this is like awesome for me. They told me this was going to be a part-time job and it isn't. I need someone else to like, do this, do that, and the other thing. And I'll still help out. I'll still meet with the startups, but like I need someone else to run this thing. So I kind of leaned back and I said, so Mark, you're saying that you want someone else to come in and do all the hard stuff and then you get to keep doing the fun stuff. Yeah, that's it. Interested?
And the answer was yes.
Yeah, that was exactly yes. Why would I say no to such a great offer?
And so that was sort of the beginning. Well, not exactly the beginning. You did family office before. So then, since then, and up until you wrote this book, has that been your bread and
Yeah.
butter, working
So
in
that
different
was,
VCs?
yeah. So there've been a couple of phase changes in my life. Right. So when I went from like consulting, working with Fortune 100 companies to doing a startup, that was a phase change, right? That's a radical change in how you think about things, how fast you have to move, the level of detail you need to go into before you're like, I got to do it this way. Like that was a big change in mindset. And I think that's actually fairly common across all types of entrepreneurs. The next phase change was a little bit from like entrepreneur to angel investor, meaning just investing my own money. When and if I saw something I liked, that was a smaller change. It was kind of like, okay, I've done it. I can see what works. But I was also kind of, to be brutally honest, more lucky than good at that point. But then when I went from like, okay, I see a couple of startups each month, I might invest in none of them, to running a program that I needed to have 12 startups all start this program at the same time, which meant that I had to look at, I kid you not, over 1,000 startups
Wow.
in 2 months. That was a phase change. That was like, oh my God, like I have to find a different way to get the startups through the door. I have to find a different way to filter them. I have to find a different way to score them, interview them, select them. That was a big change. Even though it seems like, oh, you went from angel to VC, what's the big deal? It was actually a huge change.
And that's, you know, often talk about VCs having pattern recognition, right? I assume that that's something that comes from
Yes.
repetitious thing and seeing so many startups.
Yeah, there's an analogy I use. I think I have it in the book as well. Startups are like a chain. They're not like a rope. So the main difference between a rope and a chain is if like a strand or two on the rope is frayed, the rope will still hold. But a chain, if you have one broken link, the chain's useless. Now, here's one of the differences between a small business startup and a tech startup. Usually, if you're doing a small business startup, a bunch of the chains are kind of given. You know they're okay, right? If you're starting a consultancy, you kind of know what that looks like as a business. You kind of know what your clients are willing to pay. if you're running a car wash, you can kind of figure out how much water do you need, right? So what's the machinery cost? So you can be pretty certain that those links on the chain are good. And for you, the biggest link on the chain that you need to test is like, how do I get the customer in the door? Right? What's the top line revenue? How do I make that sale? Those are the weaker chain links or link if you're doing a traditional small business startup. With a tech startup, every link is up for grabs, right? It's something new to the world. You think a customer will pay $40 a month? You don't know until you test it, right? You think this is a painful enough problem that people will want to be solved. You can talk to as many customers as you want to vet it, but there comes a point where you just got to go check that link, test the link.
That's a great analogy. So we're kind of naturally glo sliding into talking about the book. So maybe a quick step back. Tell us, how did you decide to become an author? How did you come up with a topic? And it's not your traditional nonfiction book. It's something pretty unique.
Yeah, seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah.
Now I'm in that mood. I'm just going to see how many of your questions I can answer that way. No, okay, I'll give you the genuine answer. So it's something that's been in the back of my mind for a long time. So there, let's take it step by step. So as I started to work with startups at scale, like a lot of startups at scale, I had some advice, right? Okay, you're doing this, probably not the right way to do it. What I noticed was the advice that stuck, or that they got like right away, was when I was telling them a story about another startup in a similar situation and how they solved it. But I could tell them, like, you need to do this, you want to test it early. But if I tell them the story about how a company like SeatGeek almost never was, because they were going to do this and that would have gotten there nowhere, but they figured out a way to test that quickly and cheaply before putting all their chips down on it, then all of a sudden, like, the light bulbs go off, and, like, I got it. So, with that realization that the stories actually are more memorable, they're more impactful than just dry advice, which kind of makes sense, right? Take a quick tangent here. Like, how many religious books do you know are like, okay, here are the rules you have to follow? They're all stories, right? Every single book is a story with the morals embedded in it, because
And
that's
it
how.
goes also from right in being someone's opinion that you don't know why they have that opinion to something that's real,
So now
tangible.
it's tied to something. It's tied to, like, oh, I know SeatGeek. Wow, that's the story of it. Now, it may still be just one data point, but I guess it goes from zero data points to one data point. But yeah, so it's a more memorable, more interesting, and certainly more effective way to get it across. So as that's kind of dawning on me, I remembered a book that I'd read in business school called The Goal. I used to describe The Entrepreneur's Odyssey as the goal for startups. The only problem is, like, nobody under 40 knows the goal. So now I call it Lean Startup Meets The Alchemist, and people are like, oh, I get it now.
That's good.
Hat tip to my friend Matt Hiltzik, great in PR. He was the one that came up with the, like, no, you're telling people about it all wrong. So what the goal was a textbook I was given in business school, but it was written like a novel. And it was the novel of a guy that had to turn around a printing press and was totally kind of lost. And he met this consultant on the airplane who kind of talked him through the process, mentored him through the process. And at each point in the story, it wasn't just two guys talking about the business. It was like things that were going on in his life that pulled that lesson to the fore. Now, to be honest, it wasn't super well written, but then it was a hell of a lot more interesting than any of the other textbooks. So competition was pretty sparse. And it's probably the only textbook I remembered from any of my undergrad or business school. So, like, that was in the back of my mind. Then on the other side, I'm like, I tell this advice as stories, it seems to work better. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to make up a story about a startup, fictional startup, based on a real startup, of course. And I'm going to embed all the lessons that I needed to teach a startup, or that I wanted to teach a startup, from taking an idea to product and taking it from product to funding, right? All that, I'm going to try to embed those within a novel about the journey of this one particular founder, Marcus, and his startup Call Jar.
That's awesome. And then was it easy to write once you got that concept?
Yeah, there was about 6 years of procrastination, and that was like, boom. Yeah, no, so always super busy. You know, I had another phase change in my life around 2021 when Dreamit decided to get out of the sectors I was in. So then I ended up doing like four or five other things, you know, some consulting, working with a different fund. And at that point, I kind of, you know, it hit me like, listen, if I'm ever going to do this, now is the time that I have the flexibility to do it. So, you know, fish or cut bait. Sorry, that was the second expression I was going to use. The first one, I'm like, it's a family show. I can't say that. So at that point, there's like, I'm going to use like the game time and clock time analogy, right? Probably took me a little under 2 months to actually write it, but it was split up into 5 minutes at a time over like 8, 9 months because I'm totally undisciplined. And because the way I wrote it was me muttering into my phone, speech to text directly into Google Docs. I spent 20 minutes up front outlining it because I knew what I wanted to say. And then every time I was on the way to a meeting and I'm like, oh, I have an idea for how to do this, open it up and just dictate.
Yeah, it's a great approach. I spent years writing a book, and by the time I was almost done, I felt it was outdated and not relevant anymore. So
It
you
had to be a
definitely,
sprint for
it's
me.
real. The writer's block, or you know, whatever you call it, it's hard because writing, I think, is different than many other things. It's so intensely personal what comes out of it. I think it's just like drawing a painting, or at least to me, it felt like that.
Yeah, no, you know, it just occurred to me that in a way, so I had done a lot of articles in the past, and I enjoy writing. People seem to like my voice, I guess. I don't know. But all those articles were like 500 to 800 words because that's what people read. And they were all first person, right? They're me talking. So in a way, that was like angel investing, and writing the book was like being a VC. It was taking it to a whole new level just in terms of just page count, first of all. But also in the ability to maintain a kind of consistent narrative, consistent tone, to have multiple characters that don't all the sound the same, to tell the story as a series of actual anecdotes in the real life of the character, rather than two people sitting at a WeWork conference room table looking at the pitch deck. It was taking it like a step level higher. I didn't realize that when I started. I wonder if I would have not done it had I realized how much of a change it was.
That's great. No, I think that comes through clearly. The old grumpy guy is very has a clear, distinct personality, which is endearing and feels real too.
So you know how I did that? You want a little glimpse behind the curtain?
Who's the real guy?
So they're all real guys. Everyone in books, I know how I sound, but to make something sound like someone else, for every individual character in the book, I have a very real person in mind. And I just say, okay, now he's going to say it. And the way he said it, so it went in the book. So Jason, the investor, the angel investor who's the mentor in the book, is loosely based on a guy, John Ason, who died a few years ago. And he was one of the OGs of the New York angel investing scene. Got to know him pretty well earlier on in my career, even went on a road trip to South Korea with, which is kind of funny. And he had a very distinctive kind of voice to him. So, you know, it's part him, part me. And the founder is one of the founders in an EdTech cohort that I ran, who had that, to my mind, really good mix of kind of no nonsense. Everything I'm doing, I've thought through. But you know, hey, I based it on this logic. If the logic's wrong or if the facts are wrong, no drama. You know, where I am, and I'll do it differently.
So if you don't mind, let's jump into the book a little bit. I have a few areas, and you know, like we started looking a little bit with a filter of, you know, this makes sense from a VC funded startup perspective, and how does this relate to more of a product startup? And one thing you know, you said in part one, laying the foundation that for any startup to be ready for funding, it has to solve a painful, prevalent, and persistent problem.
I call them the three dimensions of pain. Actually, I'll give you an example in the physical product world for one of the students in the class I teach. Right? So I'm teaching, it's very much tech startups. One of the girls in my class, she's like, oh, I've been wanting to make this product where it's a hairbrush, but it's like an integrated, I don't know if it's a mister or whatever you call it, so that, you know, while you're doing, you travel, it's got its own little reservoir of liquid and It's easy to use on the go. I don't know if, I mean, look at my hair, it's not for me, but for my kids maybe. So, for her, we went through it. Like, is it a super painful problem? Dimension number one. She's like, oh man, you have no idea how many, like, how many hours and years of my life I've spent doing this. And when I travel, like, that's why my bag is twice as big as everyone else. I'm like, okay, sounds painful. Then is it prevalent? Is it just you or is it a lot of people? And she's like, look around the room. Everyone with hair longer than this, it's a problem for them. Now, in the real world, you go out there and you would verify that. You would talk to them. But like, I'm willing to give it to her on this one because I'm pretty sure it's not just her. I'm pretty sure it's everybody with long hair, or everyone with long hair who cares about what they look like. And then I say, is it a frequent problem? And she's like, I brush my hair every day. I'm like, oh yeah, I'll buy that. Now, if it's only for travel, then it's how many times they travel. So it's a little less frequent. But if it's something you use every day, then like that hits all three dimensions of pain.
And of course, a lot of product and nurse think about it. But we also see, we have a lot of folks coming to us, thousands every month with ideas they want to work with. And I think that the bad ones, the ones that don't succeed, are typically haven't asked that question. They just have an idea. Oh,
Yeah,
I
and they
think that,
usually.
this drinking cup would be awesome if it glows in the dark. But
Yeah, so
yeah, that
they
might be
fail on one
neat.
or two of those. Like, one is it's something I really want. And they haven't really gone out there and said, well, yeah, it's just you, dude. Right? No, no one else has that problem, but they feel it intensely. So they kind of assume everyone else does. So that happens a lot. And the other time, sometimes they've fallen in love with what they can do, but it's not really solving the problem. It's kind of a solution in search of a problem. Those are really where the things fall apart. If it's that basic in the problem statement.
Yeah, and then I'm jumping to chapter three. This one is about the elevator pitch. But I think it's very relevant even if you don't raise outside money. So he asks the old mentor like four questions. First, your company name. Think through it thoroughly because that's
Well, people just forget it sometimes. It's not, I'm not kidding you. They just forget to put their name in that.
But then the following three questions: who are you selling to specifically? What makes you a quantum level better than what's already out there? And then finally, what's your traction? And the traction one, but I love the first two. Who are you selling to specifically? Because if you don't know that, right, like you said, if it's just something that I think would be cool, like no, if you don't have a clear picture of who the buyer is, then odds
And
are you're not.
it may not be the same person who pays or who benefits or who decides. They can be three different people. Like, healthcare is all messed up because the patient benefits, we hope, right? The person who makes the decision is a combination of the doctor and the insurer. And then who pays is the insurer, and maybe the employer, right? And then maybe the patient too. So there are three totally different parties overlapping in all these things. It's not like a candy bar, right? I benefited, I made the decision, the money was from my pocket. But again, it's subtle. Like I was talking to actually I was teaching a course for as a guest lecturer for a friend, and one of the women in front had a makeup business. And we were talking about pricing. It's like, well, it's $200 for a guest in the party and $400 for the bride. And I said, if it's a guest, who pays? She goes, oh, the guest pays. Does the bride pay? Well, sometimes the bride will pay for her bridal party, but all the other guests pay. Like, that's what I mean, right? You got to be that granular about it. It's not just I sell the bridal parties. I sell to the bride for her and her entourage, or to any of the other guests that want to take advantage of the service, I sell to them directly.
And I think why this is so important in the product, consumer product space too, is that if you're going to build a successful business, it's rare that you only have one product, right? So even if you launch with one SKU, one product, you really need to have multiple different products you're going to follow on and sell to that same customer. So I think it's very, very helpful to think of in very much in a lot of details, like who is it that's going to buy this? Is this, the guy that goes hunting on the weekends? So you may start with a rifle holster, but then you have all types of other products that you can sell to that same consumer, right?
Or let's flip it. I'm only going to sell this one product. It's like a type of toolkit, but am I selling it to the individual technician or am I selling it to their employer as part of the kit they give? So you really have to think those through. I mean, I'm not saying any one is the right answer, but you need to know, you have to have a good reason why you've gone, one path versus the other.
Yeah. And do you think is that more important in B2B than B2C? Because I totally see
Yeah,
what you're saying. It's like,
it's more, it's usually more B2B, but the classic example in B2C is breakfast cereal, right? Kid wants, mom buys.
Yeah.
So you got to
100%.
get through even there. And it could be a little, it could be even like college guidance, right? The student benefits, parent decides again. So even in direct to consumer, it can be a little more nuanced than that. But the key thing is like, oh, I sell to colleges. You don't sell to colleges. You sell to the dean of admissions at a college. You got to be super granular about that.
And then the second question, what makes you a quantum level better than what's already out there? I think it's another real good one, right? Like, is this
Yeah.
just an also ran copycat, just like different color
No.
than the existing product,
Yeah,
or
so
you're
like
really
copycat, I'm not
differentiated?
even thinking about that because usually the issue is they'll make something that's a little bit better. And it's legitimately better. It's just a little bit better. Now, think about your day. You have certain tools that you use, right? I'm using Gmail. I like Gmail. Well, gee, you should share, you switch over to Outlook. Why? Well, it's better at this. And
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, it is a little better at this, but I know how Gmail works. I know all the ins and outs. I'm a power user. I'm not going to leave that all behind, go through all the pain and suffering of learning how to do all those cool things in Outlook, find things probably that I can't do in Outlook that Gmail's a little better. I just don't know about that yet. And net net, I won't be ahead, or I'll be ahead in one area or behind another. Like for me to undertake that journey, to overcome that inertia, it has to be such a big difference. You're like, God damn it, that's so important to me that I'm willing to like start from zero with a new product. That's why it has to be quantum level better. Small improvements, they just, it's very hard to get people to switch.
Yeah, no, we work with one of the aggregators in the e-commerce Amazon space, and they shared a bunch of interesting data around that, incremental small improvements are easy to make, and they made a lot of them, but the shelf life of that product was very short. So they may generate some more sales in a short period of time, but if it's easy to make that addition, then all the
And that's an
copycats, the
existing
follow-on is going to do the
customer.
same thing.
They're not asking other people to switch. They're asking their own people to add stuff. And that's an easier case. I'll also give you one other corollary to it. There's some startups like, well, there's, I understand these are small improvements, but there's 20 small improvements, so it adds up to a big change. Math doesn't work that way with customers. Don't work that way.
Chapter five, you talk about creating customer personas. You see that in all tech companies. That's sort of standard best practice. I think a lot of product entrepreneurs kind of miss
Same
that.
thing.
They don't quite go deep enough.
Yeah, you'll sometimes hear it called an ICP or an ideal customer profile. You got to have, like, if you can't visualize who it is that's holding that brush mister or who's holding that, new rainbow colored cup, if you don't have like an actual image of that person, visualize them going about their day and when they would use it and how they're using it, you don't understand your customer well enough. You sometimes hear like the jokes when you talk about polling or product marketing. Oh, it's soccer moms, right? Or, divorced dads or whatever it is. And it kind of has a silly shorthand, but it works in that you have enough of a mental image that you can see like it works through the day. So like we got a new car and it has that, automated tailgate that comes up. Now, but what it has is you can kind of just swing your foot under the bumper and it senses it and it'll open it up. And if you're like, oh, it's to soccer moms, immediately you're thinking they got their hands full of stuff. They can't take one half off to push the button or to take their
And then they
key
have this
out.
Stanley drinking cup in one hand,
Yeah,
purse,
exactly.
and
And it's like absurdly large drinking cup here, like, all the soccer or hockey gear in the other hand, but they can kick their feet out. So, that kind of shorthand, you can kind of see it, right? You kind of get it. And if you don't understand them that well, you're not going to know, will this feature work for them or not? Because you can't actually put yourself in the flow of their day and kind of empathize with them enough to figure out that, yeah, they're going to press that because that's important. Or no, they're going to skip it because they're in a rush and they have to do other stuff.
Yeah, that's great. Jumping up to chapter seven, you talk about the MVP, the minimum viable product. And it's something that it's almost overused in the tech circles, right? You cannot talk to anybody, and MVP is used in a lot of different ways. But what I love, and I'd let you talk about my perception reading Lean Startup, sometimes people just think it's a prototype, it's something. But the way the author of Lean Startup describes it is the very smallest thing that you can create in order to get some customer feedback, right? So it can be a piece of paper, it can be a audio recording, it can be anything. And I think sometimes in the product space, people miss out on that too. It's like that you could actually create particularly today with generative AI, you could create an image of the product you intend to create and get feedback
Or
on that before you spend a dime.
3D printer for like a plastic model of it. Put it in somebody's hands, let them touch it and turn it over. It's never been easier to do that. You know, the mistake people make in this world when it's oh, we're just going to code the whole damn thing. You know, they're a programmer. They're really like, they have that vision in their mind. They want to get it all down. They spent months building it. They find out that three quarters of what they built, no one cares about. The example I give in the book and the chapter you're talking about is the index card app. All right. So it's easy to think, well, you know, if I were making a hairbrush, I could just like jerry-rig something together and show it to people. But how do I do that with a startup, with an app? So the idea is for the cost, like for the $5.97 it takes to buy a pack of index cards, you get your pack of index cards, get a pen, you sketch out what each screen of your site's supposed to look like, purposely, you know, not making it pretty, just functional. And then you go and say, listen, Henrik, I want to give you my app. I don't have an app, but these index cards are the screens of my app. I want you to interact with them exactly the way you'd interact with them if it were the phone. If you want to press a button, press a button. I'll give you a new card when you get to the next screen. You can't ask me questions because I'm not going to be there for you when you get the app. The one thing I will ask you to do differently is just verbalize what you're thinking, right? Because I can't read your mind. So if you're like, I don't know what this button does and I'm afraid of it, I'm not going to press it. Say that out loud, right? But other than that, I'm going to sit here quietly. I'm just going to hand you cards depending on what you do. So if you've sketched out your end vision for the app and you run that through 20 or 30 customers, potential customers, and you see that none of them click on a certain feature, you know, at the end of that demo, you can say, okay, Henrik, we're gonna break character here for a minute. I noticed like on this page, you didn't click on that button. What was going through your mind there? And you're like, yeah, I don't really need that. Well, now you've learned something. Don't code that feature. So, and it cost you $5.97 for the index cards, a nickel's worth of ink, and just time with customers.
That's great advice. One more I'd love to cover is like this is chapter 11, de-risking the model. This is something I think that a lot of product entrepreneurs miss or don't go detailed enough because, you know, if you're pitching a VC or you have a board of directors, right, there's tremendous scrutiny to the financial model that you develop. You have to really know everything. And I think it's, you know, when you're a solopreneur, you're building your own product, there's probably nobody asking you all those tough questions. And I see that often that, you know, you may not consider all the costs. You know, what are the landed costs of bringing a product in from a different country, tariffs, all that stuff. And then whatever it is, repackaging, fulfillment, storage, fees from the marketplace, all the stuff that, you know, I believe I don't have any data supporting it. A lot of folks, you know, they make a great product, but they haven't really thought through the entire financial model surrounding it.
So the best founders of any type do this for themselves, not for their investors or anyone else. Because you can, for $0 and cents, build a model of your business in Excel or Google Sheets and use that to test things, right? So let's take a silly example that works for everything. You want to go on Facebook and run ads. That's how you get people to download your app or buy your, you know, new kind of Mr. Brush. But you want to do a Facebook ads. So some people, like the first time founders, like, oh, I'm going to build it and then I'm going to see what happens. The smart founders, like, they built this model and they realized that, okay, if I put this much money down, it costs me this much per click. These numbers of people who click through actually buy. The average price is this. You know, the cost per unit is that. Okay, and that's how much money I make. Then in each one of those phases, there were assumptions that they made. Assumption number one, it's going to cost me this much for these many impressions. Assumption number two, I'm going to get this many, this percentage of them are going to click. Number three, those percentage of them are going to actually buy. Four, this is the average purchase price. You can kind of control that because you're setting the price. And then your costs, which you probably should know. So these two, they're pretty good, but the first three are unknown, but they're easy to test. And you want to go back to testing, like before you do anything, take $100, put it on Facebook ads, create a BS website, just Shopify, Wix, whatever it is. It looks real, but it's not real. Who cares? Right? And just see, if I put $100 in, how many clicks do I get? How many people get to the product page and say, buy now? And then you could say, like, hey, it's coming soon, right? Okay, sorry, it's not ready yet. But at least you know how many people hit buy now. So you can then get actual data for those three assumptions, put them back in your model. And if you find out that, oh my God, it just costs too much to get those clicks, there's no way I can make enough money per unit to sell this thing, then don't do it.
Yeah.
There, in like a week, you figured out that this is not what you want to spend the next year of your life on.
Yeah.
The good
That's
founders do
great.
it themselves.
It's really to your point, it's inexcusable not to do those things, right? Whether
Oh, it's
it's your
only
own
broken
money or
out
somebody
if in
else's money.
retrospect.
Go
Right?
ahead.
First time we all made those mistakes. I
Yeah.
made those mistakes myself.
Yeah. But there's so many tools now, just like you said, easy to spend $100 on Facebook. There's tools like Pickfu and other things you can create an image and have consumers that are in your target audience pick the better website or the better product design or whatever it is. You know, there's so many things that you can do, and like you said, good entrepreneurs do them for
Yeah, and this
themselves.
is actually, for my world, it's a two-edged sword. But for your world, I think it's predominantly positive. And I'll tell you why it's a two-edged sword on my side. Because it's so easy to do these things, now as VCs, we've raised the bar. But it used to be like, you get to here. That was a lot of work. Great, you can get money. Now you can do all those other things for very little. I need you to be this high, right? You could do so much more with so much less now. I want more progress before I give you the money because someone else did. And that means he's a better entrepreneur than you. He's going to out-hustle you. He's going to out-compete you. He's going to be smarter than you. Now, if you're bootstrapping, the bar's not raised. You still go out there. You still have to make sales. So you just get all the benefits of all the things that have gotten easier. And then the actually going out there and getting sales part, well, that's always hard, but that at least hasn't gotten harder. You can skip the, convince some old conceited dude to give you money to get their part.
Yeah, great. So we started to run out of time. I could talk about every chapter of this book. It's an excellent read. I recommend it to everyone. We'll add a link below, but it's The Entrepreneur's Odyssey by Andrew Ackerman. Andrew, any if people want to learn more about you, the book,
Sure.
where should they go?
I have a website. Not awesome, but it'll tell you a little bit more about me. It's Andrew, the letter B as in boy, Ackerman. Middle name's Benjamin, hence the name. You can go there, tell you a little bit more about my background, the things that I do. There'll also be a little bit more about the book. If you're like, I don't care about you, Andrew, I just want to get the damn book already. It's on Amazon, it's on Barnes and Noble. It's easy enough to find.
That's great. Any final words of advice to our listeners before we say goodbye?
I thought about this kind of long and hard. The number one characteristic that you want to cultivate as an entrepreneur is empathy. And I don't mean that as kind of a soft and fuzzy thing, but I mean that the ability to put yourself in someone else's shoes, it's critical. Like I gotta put myself in the customer's shoes and see what resonates. I want to put myself in the shoes of like the VC and understand what his day is like or her day is like. That'll help you get funding. To put yourself in the shoes of your co-founder, if you have one, your employees, which you will have, right? That skill, that ability to see it through other people's eyes and become them for that moment in time, that's the number one thing you can cultivate as a personal characteristic to influence your success in any entrepreneurial, sorry, any entrepreneurial odyssey.
Yeah, that's great. Andrew, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. Thanks for writing the book. I think a lot of people can really benefit from it. And thanks for your time. Best of luck. And what's
Thanks for
next?
having me. This was fun.
Yeah, thank you. All righty, this is Henrik Johansson again. Thank you so much for listening to Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. If you are a successful product entrepreneur or you work in a company that creates new products and you have an interesting story about how you developed your product and brought it to market, and you would like to be on this podcast, please go to Gemba.com and click on podcast, and you can fill out an application to be on the podcast. We'd love to hear from you. If you liked this podcast, you enjoyed this interview, and we would greatly appreciate if you would share it on social media. You can just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post on socials. If you know anyone that you think would be a great guest, please tag them on social media and let them know about the show, and include the hashtag Innovator Insights. And would love to see your posts and any suggestions you have to guests. That's how we find most of our guests, from suggestion from other listeners. We're regularly putting out new episodes and new content to make sure you don't miss any episodes. Please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show and to mean a ton to me and the team. We really appreciate it. Do you want to know more about Gemba, me, or the podcast? Please go to Gemba.com and click on podcast, or you can follow me on LinkedIn. That's where I do most of my posts. Again, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Have a great day.